Yeah, so I say B2B buyers want a consumerized experience, not a consumer experience. There's a difference. A consumerized experience is one that resembles a consumer experience, but is tailored to B2B buyers.
All that and more in this episode of the Commerce Tomorrow Podcast.
Welcome to the Commerce Tomorrow Podcast. Your one stop to learn about the technology that's powering the future of commerce. Here are your hosts, Dirk and Kelly.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Commerce Tomorrow podcast. I'm here today with my co-host, Kelly.
Hello.
And today, our special guest is Andy Hoare, CEO of Paradigm B2B. Hey, Andy, how are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being on our podcast. Andy, for those who don't know you in person, do you mind giving a quick intro to your career to date? Where did you start and what brought you to B2B?
Sure. So the one word I always use to describe my background, especially for the work I do today, is eclectic. I don't think anybody, nor including me, expected the career that I ended up having. It sort of took lots of different twists and turns. And what I learned recently is that it actually benefited me greatly that I had sort of a broad range of experiences. So when I graduated from university, I worked in antitrust economic consulting. Don't ask. Did that for 5 years, learned a lot about how markets operated, and then I decided I wanted a change of pace. So I moved to Silicon Valley, got a job as a product manager, had never done it before, working in a tech company, had never done that before. And, it was a baptism by fire, but I loved it. I did it for several years. Then I started my own software company, which was well ahead of its time. We ended up selling the IP from it, but I've had the experience of being an entrepreneur. I had to raise money. I had to wind up and wind down operations. So I've done all that stuff for better or for worse. Then I was a consultant for a while. And then I talked my wife into going back to graduate school because I knew it was now or never. So she was kind enough to let me do 2 master's degrees in 3 years. So then I graduated from that and trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I remembered some folks I knew from Forrester. And so I just literally on a whim reached out to somebody I used to know from Forrester. And it turns out that she was hiring at the time. And one thing led to another. I became an analyst. I started out doing B2C work, but I think at one point we had 18 analysts in our e-commerce team. 17 of them were covering B2C. I was the only person at Forrester, and I was the only person in the world who was covering B2B. And I remember thinking at the time, this is either a genius move or an idiot move. I'm not quite sure which one it is, but I think in hindsight, it turned out to be surprisingly a genius move. So I've been covering B2B for now my 10th year.
Wow, that's pretty remarkable. And what about post-Forrester?
Yeah, so I left Forrester in late 2017 to start my own consulting firm called Paradigm B2B, where I really wanted to work more closely with mid-market companies in particular. But I saw an opening in the marketplace. If you're a wealthy, big, mega company, enterprise-like company, you can afford Forrester and Gartner. But there were many, several $100 million companies that were falling through the cracks. And I knew they had the same issues as enterprises did. And it's not like they had no budget, but they didn't have the budget for the Forresters, the Gartners, the IDCs of the world. And so I thought, maybe there's an opportunity here. So, I didn't reach out to anybody, actually, because I had a non-compete, so I wasn't allowed to. But people reached out to me. And they were people I'd never heard of before. So they weren't even clients from before. And so I started working with them. And I really like doing that because I get to work directly with the practitioners. I do also do some work for software companies and systems integrators. But I really try to devote most of my Paradigm work to working with practitioners and helping them solve their problems. And they do things like ask me to help them make tech selections, a lot of work around digital transformation, a lot of work around, e-commerce strategy. And I do that exclusively for B2B companies. So the other reason why I left Forrester is because I had an idea to start a conference. There was no, I would call it really good B2B e-commerce conference. People had been asking me about it for years. And so I sought the opportunity, started a conference called B2B Next, And we get between 750 and 1,000 people a year that come to the event. It is the world's largest B2B e-commerce event. And I'm really proud of what we've done with that. So we tackle all the big issues. We have several tracks that we address. And because I run the content, I wanted to create a show that I wanted to attend. And so we have some very strict rules around no pay for play. And all the content runs through me. So nobody gets on stage, literally or figuratively, with garbage propaganda. I remember I was at one event, and this is what really stuck in my craw. I was at an event once, and I went to hundreds of these things. And I remember, I'll protect the innocent here. It wasn't you guys, but one vendor was introducing another vendor on stage. And I thought, this is ridiculous. When you have vendors introducing vendors, then you got people in the audience going, wait a minute, why am I here? What am I learning? I'm just having vendors introduce vendors. So I swore that if I ever ran one of these things, we would never do that. And to this day, we have never done that. We've always had practitioner case studies, and we enforce that pretty strictly. So anyway, that's what I've been doing. And I joke with my wife that I said, look, I'll spend 50% of my time on Paradigm and 50% of my time on B2B Next. And I actually spend 100% of my time on both.
Yeah, I know the feeling on that one. Very good. We'll get more into B2B Next a little bit later. But let's go back to Forrester for a minute. How did you spend your early days there? Was it doing primary research? Was it writing? Was it speaking? Like, what did a typical day look like for you back then?
Well, the answer to that is yes, yes, and yes. One of my former colleagues and still a good friend of mine, Sutrita Molparu, she's since gone with her married name now, but it's Kodali, but I'll never be able to not call her Sutrita Molparu because that's why I knew her. But so Sutrita, I like to say, was sort of like a mentor to me. When I first started at Forrester, I said, I want to work with somebody who knows what they're doing. And she needed some help because she was so busy and I didn't know what I was doing at Forrester. So I went and became her kind of apprentice a little bit. And I remember once she told me, at Forrester, you're part journalist, part researcher, and part consultant. And I would say that's very accurate. You do spend some of your time gathering stories and writing things. You spend a lot of your time researching, which is beyond story writing. That's looking at data, constructing surveys, analyzing vendors, et cetera. And then you part consultant. We did a lot of consulting work. In fact, many people didn't know we did that kind of work. They thought we just wrote research and they would ask us questions like, hey, can you help us put together this project or, something like that? And they'd say, well, yeah, of course. I go, really? You guys offer that? I'm like, yeah, that's what I spend like half my time doing. So it was one of the underplayed areas at Forrester was consulting. But, I actually also like to joke that even though we were part-time, journalist, researcher, consultant, we were full-time therapists. And what I mean by that is whether it was a practitioner or a vendor, it didn't matter. I swear to you, I spent most of my time, especially on my inquiry calls, essentially acting like a doctor in a way. You get on the phone and they say, okay, what would you like to talk about? And say, well, I'm having a problem with this. And then we would talk through it for a while. And then some people would complain about their circumstances and they'd say, I don't have enough money and I'm trying to do this, I'm trying to do that. And we'd end up actually talking them through it. And after doing this for, I don't know, a year or two, I realized it does kind of feel like I'm, maybe not Freud, but I'm sitting on a couch and there's somebody laying in front of me bearing all, because frankly, that's what we do as consultants and as analysts is we're actually pretty much solving problems for people. And, a lot of people look to us for guidance, soundboarding. I do a lot of that, and I used to think that wasn't of much value when I first started there, but I realized over time that's of tremendous value because people have their heads down all day long. They're doing work, they're delivering things, they're getting paid for results. They don't have time to sit around and go, huh, let's throw some pencils at the ceiling and think about what's going to happen over the horizon in digital, So they come to us and they'll present ideas and we'll present ideas. And you realize how valuable that is in hindsight that you've given them opportunity to think through what they're doing. Sometimes they don't have people in their own work environments they can do that with. And frankly, that was the most enjoyable part of the job for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. Very good. So historically, B2B is always perceived as being behind B2C in terms of maturity and capabilities. First, do you think that's a fair assessment? And second, why is that?
Yeah, I think it's a tale of two worlds, tale of two cities, if we want to use a novel. You know, I've often felt that in some regards, B2B lagged, and in some regards, it led. So nobody would ever accuse B2B of lagging B2C in terms of fulfillment, for example, or use of technology for tracking inventory. You know, in the supply chain, you know, B2B was every bit as good, if not better, than B2C. I think it was more on the demand chain side, the customer-facing part, where B2B lagged. And part of that is because the B2B model was very salesperson-centric. You had a lot of B2B companies that, you know, the way they went to market was through people, whether they be salespeople or channel partners, but people. I remember, you know, I would talk to B2B companies, and one of the first questions I would ask, which you think would be a really simple question to answer, is who is your customer? And many B2B companies, especially brand manufacturers, would tell me they're channel partners. And I'd say, well, then what about the people who actually use your product? What do you call them? They go, oh, those are our customers' customers, or the end user. I'm like, well, what do you do when an end user comes to your website because they did a Google search and your name popped up and they went to your site, Mr. Brain Manufacturer, and they want to learn more or buy something? Oh, we'll send them to our channel partner. I'm like, God, this is like an infinite loop. So, you know, that was, I think, one of the challenges is how you go to market and who you consider to be your customer. That's always been a challenge for B2B companies. And now, especially what has happened with the pandemic, it's really forced the issue. So I've done a lot of work in the last year with companies understanding how they can kind of reinvent themselves for a digital first world, and brand manufacturers in particular. But, you know, what I've found is that when they've decided on something and when they figure something out, they move pretty quickly. It's just they're kind of risk averse, because with B2C, these are many times personal decisions. You know, if I go on Amazon and I want to buy a new Alexa device, I can do that. And by the way, I hope I didn't say everybody's Alexa's on there. But if I need to buy something for work, you know, if I make the wrong decision as a consumer, I just have to answer to my wife. If I make a bad decision as a B2B buyer, I could lose my job. So many B2B buyers are very risk averse. They're also really efficient. You know, unlike B2C, where there's a social dimension, like I'll wander around a site, you know, because I'm a researcher and an analyst, because if I want to buy something, I'll spend a lot of time looking around and doing research because I enjoy doing that. I don't have time to do that at work. If I'm getting paid and I'm going to be there between certain hours, ostensibly, I'm not getting paid to wander around. It's not a social experience. I don't need to try things on, you know, like I do maybe if I'm going to a store. So B2B buyers, I always say the word is they're efficient. They want to get in, they want to get out, which means if you're a vendor, puts a premium on things like search, you know, stripping away friction. You know, I've found with a lot of B2B buyers, if they go to a site and it's too hard to buy something, they'll just leave. And B2C, you know, consumers will stick around if they think there's something compelling about it or if it's fun. But B2B buyers are like, if I can't get in and get out quickly, and that includes, by the way, making people log in and register for things. That was a battle I fought years ago. I used to have this discussion. It was almost the first or second thing that we'd talk about. Do you require registration to come to your website? I mean, it's almost a silly thought now, but most B2B companies did. Today, you can go to mostly any B2B site, or you should be able to, and be able to see the catalog. Maybe you have to log in to actually make a purchase, but you have to log in to see the catalog. But 7-8 years ago, I'd say more B2B companies than not, you had to log in to see the catalog. And I said, when was the last time you went to Amazon and had to log in to see their catalog? And that usually set them straight. But I'd say today there are still some percentage of B2B companies that require somebody to log in to use the site at all. And that's the kind of friction that B2B buyers will reject.
What about the overall B2B buyer experience? In the last years, I would say that the voices became louder that said that the B2B experience will follow the B2C experience, as the B2B buyer in their evening hours is also a B2C buyer, and they expect the same compelling, I would say, look and feel than they get from other shops and apps. But when I follow your argument, and it's mostly around efficiency, then the B2B buying experience should be mostly around that, right?
Yeah, so I say B2B buyers want a consumerized experience, not a consumer experience. There's a difference. A consumerized experience is one that resembles a consumer experience, but is tailored to B2B buyers. A consumer experience is literally a consumer experience. For example, you may go to a website as a consumer, and you may see, you know, spinning this and blinking that. Well, nobody wants to see spinning this and blinking that on a B2B site. So that to me is more of a consumer experience, but a consumerized experience is one where I, you know, recommendations are personalized, where I log in or I don't log in and you know who I am. I want to be able to do one click ordering. I want a memory of my transaction history. These are things that were pioneered in B2C and now are table stakes in B2B. But I always try to separate the two. Yes, they want a consumerized experience and all the trappings associated with that, easy to use, personalized, etc. But they don't want a consumer experience.
Yeah, makes sense. As you already touched based on that, before the pandemic and now in the pandemic or hopefully soon after the pandemic, the behavior of B2B manufacturers thinking about their customer has changed. Why would you say that even today, most manufacturers don't go direct to consumer, as we have seen in the last 2 years happening strongly on B2C? I would say in B2C, one of the biggest trends of the last years was seeing the big brands going DTC. Even if they improve on the B2B side, the information part for what they might call the end customer or the customer of their channel partner. Why don't many try to, I wouldn't say bypass the channel, but also build a direct sales connection directly to the end customer?
Well, in some cases, these relationships are decades old. And I don't mean literally between people, although that's sometimes the case. I mean figuratively between companies. You see this in B2C as well. Brand manufacturers and distributors have a love-hate relationship. You know, in some ways, they're rivals. You know, buyers and sellers for one another. They negotiate prices. They're trying to gain advantage. In some cases, they don't trust one another. And we see this in B2C. You know, they'll never admit this publicly, but companies like, you know, Procter & Gamble and Walmart, you know, they battled for years. Procter & Gamble wants to get Tide on the shelves and Walmart wants to get the private label version up there because they have more margin in that. You know, so they battle back and forth over shelf space and marketing because a lot of manufacturers spend money on marketing. In fact, they use, you know, all sorts of relationships around, you know, can't remember the term for it, but when you basically, when the main brand manufacturer pays for the advertising for their product in a retail environment, co-op, I think it's called co-op funds, you know, they'll use that. And so in some ways, the retailer in the B2C environment controls the customer because they have the environment, but the brand manufacturer controls the purse strings because they're deciding how much money is going to get spent on this. And the distributor or the retailer, you know, accepts that money. So it's a complex relationship. It is in B2C, and it's even more complex in B2B. And I would say the biggest problem, and I became famous and infamous for addressing this several years ago, is the role of the salesperson in the B2B environment. I wrote a document when I was still at Forrester called Death of a B2B Salesman, which made me really, really popular with B2B salespeople. I think you probably imagine.
Was social media already at that time a big thing? So did you get a lot of bad messages?
Oh, sure. No, I was told I was nuts. It's insane. I mean, I heard everything, actually, professionally and personally. And I don't take any joy in this, but I made some predictions 5 years ago that have actually come true. It was coming true before the pandemic. And the prediction was that companies were going to radically restructure the sales model. And that in many ways, salespeople were going to become more consultative, and others like order takers were going to be the ones that were going to disappear or be moved into a different role. I mean, why do you need to call somebody on the phone to order something, which you've done for decades, when you can just go to the website, find it, add it to cart, and do it at 3 o'clock in the morning if you want, or 5 a.m. before you get up? I mean, you didn't need order taker salespeople. And that's what got displaced by websites. But, you know, companies were relying on this. In many cases, I would work with companies that were family-owned businesses, and the scion of the company, the founder of the company, his first role was selling. And, you know, I remember I would hear people say things like, well, if we need more sales, we have to hire more salespeople. And I would challenge that conventional wisdom by saying, well, you know, maybe for some things, but for reorders, you know, for commoditized purchases, maybe you should push that load to the web and let people do that on their own, and then use your salespeople to sell systems and solutions, you know, higher end, more consultative stuff, which was higher margin. But that's so much easier said than done. It's easier for me to say that. But when they turn to their sales teams and say, great idea, all those clients you were selling to and relying on for your income, they're all gone now. We're going to move them to the web, and you're going to sell a whole new class of customers. And by the way, you're going to have to be better trained. Who's in? You know, that's a hard thing to sell. Those things take time. So I always say, you know, when you're talking about digital transformation, you're really talking about business transformation. And that's hard.
Yeah, I fully agree. I think there's also one other thing on top to that, and that is that the customer, so the final customer and consumer, or however you would call it, we all, over the years have changed and developed a lot, right? And in the past, I would say 20, 30 years ago, you had been dependent from the so-called channel to retrieve product information and so on. Now everything is at your fingertips. And as long as you have companies out there that are digital native and are playing that game, I just think about home automation and surveillance, right? So before Nest, yes, maybe you need to go to a company that's setting those kind of things up for you and giving you a recommendation on products that you could buy to improve your home. Now you find everything online. And if manufacturer A offers DTC, gives you all the information at hand, but everybody else doesn't, you have a strong disadvantage. And the customer today is far more educated on a product, both in B2C and B2B, than they had been 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, and I think it raises the issue of what do you sell online if you're a brand manufacturer? Because it doesn't make sense to sell everything, but it also doesn't make sense to sell nothing. And so I've spent a lot of time with brand manufacturers on this very issue. They don't want to alienate their channel partners, but by the same token, they don't want to leave money on the table. You know, when I was at Forrester, I did some research, and it was called A Brand New Day, which I thought was a clever title. And it was about how brands need to put themselves at the center of their selling proposition. And it sounds like, again, like one of those duh statements, but you know, I used to get controversial responses from people on that. Manufacturers would say, well, we're not going to put ourselves at the center. Those are channel partners sell our product. I said, well, do they sell all your products? Well, not really. They sell the fast moving SKUs really well, and none of the long tail stuff they don't. I said, well, how do you get that? Oh, they call us. And I said, well, why don't you move that online? Why don't you sell the long tail online? Oh, but then our channel partners won't like it. I'm like, wait a minute, didn't you just tell me your channel partners are not selling it? But that's how you would characterize a lot of these conversations, is that it was a mindset. You know, I used to have people tell me, brand manufacturers would tell me, we make stuff and the channel sells it. And that was the way they thought about it, very black and white, because they were fearful that they were going to lose their channel partner. And so instead of seeing the upside, they feared the downside. And while that might sound like a good business proposition, it's risk aversion. And in a world where the world is changing, not a great idea. So I used to counsel them, hey, look at your panoply of SKUs here. Figure out which ones make sense to sell through the channel. Most likely your fast moving SKUs, the ones they can handle, the ones they can warehouse, and put your long tail on your website. where you can leverage things like deep search technology. And by the way, those don't compete with what your channel partners are doing. And what some actually found was when they were selling their long tail stuff online, guess who was going to the website to access long tail stuff for their customers? Distributors. So it became a B2B portal with their own channel partners. So, you know, I think you just got to take a hard look at what makes sense to sell what where and start with, and here's another controversial statement, your customer. Where do they want to buy from you? Not where do you want to sell to them? And again, these seem like, you know, just openly obvious statements, but I found with a lot of B2B companies that are just kind of slow to change, you got to get over these big humps before you can get to the really important stuff.
Yeah, and one other, it sounds like a minor challenge, but it seems to be something consistent over the last 20 years, is that often the data that they have about their own products is not sufficient enough. Has this improved over the last couple of years, or why is it that some manufacturers are so bad in supplying data about their own products to make them really understandable and buyable online, no matter if the purchase is happening at their site or at a partner site, and how can this be improved if it needs to be?
That's a great question. We could do a whole podcast on this. And honestly, we did tracks on this at B2B Next. And the reason I bring that up is because there isn't a simple answer to this question. But if I were to oversimplify, I think the reason why is because many brand manufacturers were used to creating physical catalogs. And those physical catalogs contain certain information in them. And, you know, just like, you know, the horse and buggy people didn't love the idea of automobiles, it takes a while to transition. And so their first instinct was to create a digital version of a physical catalog. But at some point, you have to drop the old metaphor and create, you know, think about it in the reverse. Maybe someday we'll print out our digital catalog. There's a subtle difference there. But, you know, that's where they had to start with the digital part first. And they still, in many cases, haven't done that. You know, I think up until just a couple of years ago, companies like Grainger were still publishing their, you know, several thousand page catalog. And, you know, you would ask them why they were doing that. And they'd say, well, because people still use it. Okay, I get that. But does it have to be several thousand pages in 2-point font? I mean, what's the search engine for a 2-point font, several thousand person catalog? It's not. You got to flip through, you know, you have to use the old table of contents, and you've got to go take a magnifying glass out to see exactly what the product number is. Then you're printing these things. You know, what actually stopped a lot of that, funny enough, was environmental concerns. Companies were trying to be more green, and they looked at areas where they could cut, and they looked at their catalogs and said, well, we're killing a lot of trees producing these multi-thousand page catalogs when, frankly, it's suboptimal. It's better to have people go to our website and they can do a search and find it there, and no trees are getting killed.
Yeah. You know, on that topic, it's kind of frustrating. I incorporated the Mock Alliance, and it's just a simple 501c3, no employees, no physical property, no assets, no nothing. It's just a legal entity. And Uline keeps sending me these 3-inch thick catalogs every month. And they're just gigantic. I mean, they're 3 pounds of paper each, and there's no way for me to opt out. Like, I still get these, and it drives me crazy every time I get one. There's just no way for me to opt out of these things.
Well, don't get me started on the untargeted nature of that. It's not like you're necessarily going to be buying their stuff.
Yeah, it's just frustrating. Another question for you. We see marketplaces really rising in popularity. Are marketplaces really making a big splash in the B2B space? Or I guess just tell us a little bit more about the intersection of marketplaces and B2B.
I've been a big fan of marketplaces for years. And there's some language we have to clarify here. There are first-party marketplaces and third-party marketplaces. I've never been quite be able to figure out what a second-party marketplace is. But, you know, third-party, everybody, it's on the eye of the beholder. You know, it depends on who you are. You may not refer yourself as a third-party marketplace, but as an objective observer, and I've quibbled with people in the industry about this, but I call Amazon, Alibaba, Rakuten, those to me are third-party marketplaces from the perspective of a seller. And then a first-party marketplace is a marketplace that you put up on your own website. And that could be used for many things. It could be used to sell direct using channel partners. It could be used to co-opt an industry where maybe you're a market maker and you can bring even your competitors to your site. I think of companies like 3M, that fit into that category. But I've been a big fan of it. And why? Because customers want it. If you look at the data, the research is very clear. The satisfaction with marketplaces continues to rise. And it's simple. It really is. It's because you get the broadest selection and the lowest price. Now, that's not always the case, but that's the value proposition of a marketplace. Broadest selection, lowest price. Who doesn't want that? Versus going from site to site to site to find what you're looking for, and trying to negotiate prices or not ever knowing what the price is. I mean, imagine if you had to go to 100 sites to figure out what the lowest price was versus, and I'm making this up, you go to a third-party marketplace, you log in, and there's 100 different prices. I mean, it's a much more one-stop shop convenience opportunity. And so in theory, for buyers love marketplaces. Now, sellers, on the other hand, that's a different story. I've had to work with many sellers who think that they're getting in bed with the devil, either with a third party or a first party. I think they're completely different. What you decide to sell or not sell on Amazon, or whether you decide to sell or not sell on Amazon, is a very different discussion from whether you decide to put up a first party marketplace and essentially create a better version of a dealer locator on your website. I'm a huge fan for companies that really have that kind of leverage in the industry, so large brand manufacturers, of doing first-party marketplaces. I'm also a big fan of selling something on Amazon, because it can't be the case that you have no good reason for selling anything on Amazon. For the same reason that if you're a brand manufacturer, you have no good reason for not selling anything direct, right? I believe that there are home games and away games, and you got to win them both. If you only want to win the home games by selling through your website or having a marketplace on your website, great. But what about all the people who never go to your website, all the people who are looking for these things on Amazon's site? What do you do about them? And the answer can't be, oh, we're going to get them to come to our website. I'm like, well, good luck with that one.
So where do you see gaps in the market that ISVs aren't filling? For example, do you see B2B focused marketplace vendors not existing and people have to build it on their own? Or if you look at the more B2C focused commerce platforms, where are there features that are missing for B2B? I guess, where are the gaps out there that you're seeing?
So I might give you an odd answer to this question, because what I have seen is, in the last several years, there's been, I think, an equilibration in the market. There's been a lot, people have kind of caught up with others, in particular things like the cloud. I remember before we still had companies that were doing, on-premise models competing with companies that were multi-tenant SaaS, and that just wasn't practical. So all the companies that were doing on-premise models have migrated into cloud environments, whether they're multi-tenant or single-tenant, that's another discussion for another podcast, but they've caught up. So everybody's offering cloud-based systems, but for a while, that was a real difference in the market. The other thing is, people had license models for pricing, and that was a legacy of the, no surprise here, on-premise model. And others were doing, again, cloud-based models where you have pay-as-you-grow models. And I think what's happened now is not only have companies gone cloud, but they've also gone with performance-based or pay-as-you-grow models. Now, however you capture that, you can have a license model, a license-looking model, but it's based on usage. And so that used to be a big difference in the space. That has kind of changed in the last several years. I don't think that there is anybody out there selling on-premise models actively. I mean, you may back into something like that, but that was a big difference. That's gone now. But the odd answer to your question is that I believe that too few of the platforms out there are really focused on what B2B buyers are looking for, which is how do you create compelling digital-first online experiences. Now you might say, well, of course, another dumb moment, but you'd be surprised how many buyers walk away from bake-offs, presentations, saying, I got a checklist of features and functions. These guys have 78, these guys have 77, and they expect me to make a decision based on the fact that they have one more feature. And they said, look, meanwhile, they're not doing this thing very well at all, which is helping me create, let's say, the Amazon-like customer experience. I see that regularly in RFPs. Help me create an Amazon-like customer experience. Now, that's ridiculous. And you can't just buy an Amazon. It's not like I can go to the store and buy, please give me an Amazon-like customer experience. I'll take two. You can't do that. But I think there's a general frustration on the part of buyers that what they're getting is tools and what they want is solutions. And again, this is probably another discussion for another podcast, but I always caution the ISVs, the vendors out there, don't go into this to win the checklist wars. Yes, checklists are important, but I can tell you what matters a lot more to the buyers is seeing how you can enable experiences quickly and inexpensively and iteratively. And so you can decide, you know, which vendor out there or vendors out there are actually delivering that. Again, I will say this again. I hear this all the time. Everybody tells me about time to market and total cost of ownership. Every presentation I get from a vendor tells me that. Not everybody is delivering that. I'm not going to rule on that here, but I can tell you those are table stakes now. And so if you, and I've had many companies tell me this, vendors, that they think that's their differentiator. I'm like, that's a bit like saying an engine and wheels are a differentiator for your car. No, people expect you to have an engine and wheels. And maybe your engine's better and maybe your wheels are better. But just to say we have a fast time to market and we have a low total cost of ownership, it better be really fast and the other one better be really low if you're going to be any different, because that isn't differentiated anymore.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good example. And I also think that's a wrap now because we are already over time. Andy, thank you so much for being at the podcast. There have been hundreds of things that we could discuss. I think that leaves room for another episode. And in the meantime, if anybody has questions, especially on B2B commerce, just reach out to Andy directly, either through his company website, LinkedIn, or other channels. And good luck for 2021 with all the projects that you're managing.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here. Yeah,
thanks, Andy.